Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to parent a child with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? And what happens when mom shares the same challenges? When her 9-year-old son, nicknamed Buzz, was diagnosed with ADHD and a comorbid condition called oppositional defiant disorder, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Ellison found much of her personal life devoted to helping him and the rest of the family cope. 3 years in, she decided to also devote a year of her work life to researching what science has learned about attention deficit and to sharing what she herself had learned as both a professional and a parent after being diagnosed with the same disorder. Her new memoir is called Buzz, A Year of Paying Attention. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris.
So your first sign that Buzz might have a problem came when he started second grade. Can you talk about what sorts of reports you were getting back from school at that time?
Yes, it's really common for kids who end up being diagnosed with ADHD to start buckling under the pressures around that time, age 9, second grade. The schoolwork gets harder and the social challenges get harder. And that's what happened to my son. So teachers were complaining, and he was also getting a lot of discipline for things that actually were beyond his control. He was getting detentions just for moving around in his chair. And forgetting his homework, which I realized later was quite unfair and pretty harmful to him.
And literally 20 minutes into your appointment with the doctor who gave you the diagnosis, that doctor recommended medication. Can you talk about your reaction to that?
I think it was less time than that, and I was so skeptical of it. You know, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area and am pretty crunchy, drive a Prius, gave my child organic food for most of his life. I really, really was opposed to stimulants, and I was also very suspicious that somebody could make a decision after such a short interaction with my son. So it was at least 2.5 years after that recommendation that we ended up trying stimulants, which is a long story in itself, but the bottom line is I think that they can be helpful in a crisis, but surely aren't a magic bullet for any of these problems.
So what you did initially after the diagnosis was you worked, and Buzz worked, with a psychologist and with a tutor. What kinds of skills were they focusing on?
Well, a psychologist was helping him and helping me understand the condition, and the tutor was working with organization and just kind of making sure that he got his homework in. A lot of kids like this get penalized by the school system because they have a very short-term memory, and you know, they're told to get in their assignment the next day. They might do the whole assignment, and then at the last minute, it kind of sabotage themselves by forgetting to put it in their backpack, you know, or forgetting to put their name on it. And schools are pretty, you know, there's still a lot of misunderstanding of this condition, what kids with it can and can't do. So that was a big problem for him, but we did get some extra help and more help as I learned and understood more about what are the most effective ways to cope with it.
So let's talk about your history. You were not diagnosed as a child, but sort of looking back and then studying up, I guess, on how this disorder can manifest itself in adults, you started to recognize yourself?
Yeah, and it's pretty common for girls not to get diagnosed. We slip under the radar. Boys will act out a lot, and so that's beneficial to them sometimes because they can get some kind of treatment and help earlier. But girls were so conditioned to cooperate and not make too much noise, so often we just end up getting very anxious or depressed or whatever, and or finding ways to cope with it, which both of which I think I did. But when I watched my son getting diagnosed, like millions of parents, I realized, wow, a lot of this stuff is pretty familiar, and it was taking me back to my school days. So I got diagnosed at, I think it was age 48, and it helped explain a lot about, I had a real roller coaster of a career, and suddenly it was a relief because it just gave me a reason for a lot of crazy things that had happened.
Well, you know, it's very interesting the way you write about this because you have been very successful in your career. You have a Pulitzer Prize, but you almost see your choice to go into journalism as a kind of self-medication?
Well, I wouldn't call it a self-medication, but more like it was a very natural response to my temperament. Mm-hmm. Journalism, I think, is full of people with ADHD because just think of it. It's, you know, part of the gene research that has been done shows that many of us are novelty seekers, genetically, you know, wired to be novelty seekers. And the job of journalism is to deliver novelty to other novelty seekers. So that made total sense. Plus the urgency where you have a deadline and so you really have to block out all the distractions from your mind really was a great kind of a discipline. But once those years of, you know, I had about 20 years of being a foreign correspondent and running around wars and earthquakes, once that excitement was over, I had a much harder time coping with the more routine real world.
Talk about before anybody was diagnosed, looking back now, how your attention deficit affected your performance as a mother.
Well, yeah, I kind of got into that subject just now because whereas when I had urgent deadlines and really exciting stuff that was ever-changing and a lot of novelty and drama in my life, I coped pretty well. I mean, I managed to get along. Plus, I had, when I was working overseas in Brazil and Mexico, I always had, like, office assistants that really helped kind of keep the details from getting overwhelming. But when you're a mother, much of the work that you do is obviously very routine. There isn't that much novelty. There isn't that much positive feedback. A lot of what you do is totally taken for granted. You know, there isn't that brilliant reward of having a front page story or editors praise you. You're just slogging along with the laundry and the, you know, school schedules. And it's pretty easy to get bored and frustrated and distracted. And I really want to make the point that in the cases of genuine ADHD, the main way you get it is hereditary. Mm-hmm. It's almost as hereditary as height. So a lot of parents are in this situation. And I really wanted to write the book to give some comfort to other parents because it's so important to know that you have lots of company out there.
And in fact, you sort of look back in your own family history and suddenly understood your father and your grandfather and your great-grandfather in a very different light.
Yeah, my father got a little peeved at me for diagnosing him, but we've since made up. But he's quite a character. I mean, he's kind of got a lot of the classic symptoms, you know. And he's a wonderfully funny, charismatic, high energy guy, and he's totally charming when he wants to be. Mm-hmm. But he's also very conflict prone, and you know, can be totally distracted. And so we had a kind of a rocky period when I was growing up, but we're best of friends now. But my father's grandfather, I thought he was the truly interesting case because a lot of research shows that people with ADHD are often prone to addictive and risk-taking behavior. So I happened to find this ancestor that got the family out of Poland. He was the first in his family to emigrate during the pogroms against Jews, and he saved us from the Nazis who would come there in a couple decades. But then he went back to Poland to collect on a family inheritance. And on his way back, squandered it all on the gambling tables of Monte Carlo. So I thought he was just a wonderful, iconic kind of story of the both benefits and perils of having this condition.
Yeah, and among the perils, and you go into this, higher likelihood of auto accidents, suicide, teen pregnancies, drug abuse. So those are things that you can't sort of let slide just waiting for all the sort of benefits that come with ADHD to kick in.
That's right, and it's for parents it can be a very, very scary diagnosis in some ways. I mean, it's a relief to know that there's a name for it, it's not your fault, there's help available. But when you look at a lot of the research that's been done, you know that you have to work extra hard to avoid these really scary outcomes that are, for the majority of kids with this condition, they don't have that great long-term outcomes. There's a lot fewer that will graduate high school or college. Many more marriages break up, many more teen pregnancies. You can just go down a very depressing list. And I do want to say that there's probably a lot of kids in the United States who are overdiagnosed, who are diagnosed with ADHD without genuine cause. But for those who have an authentic case of it, the parent does have to work much harder to make sure that the child gets the support they need.
So when you started looking for books about this, it sort of comes through in everyone that the child with ADHD needs a parent that is maybe 6 inches shy of Mother Teresa in terms of patience and sort of this ability to draw on inner calm and not react. And I don't have ADHD. I'm not sure that I could react that way. It must have been 3 times as hard for you.
Well, thank you. And yeah, I often thought about how much better a mother I could be until I realized that I was just going to be as good as I could be and muster what strengths I could and try to downplay the weaknesses. But it's true that, as I found in the book, what you sometimes get when both parent and child has this condition is a lot more conflict in the family, because you're hotheads often. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just irritable and distracted, and things are going wrong, and there's a lot more arguments. And that's really why I wrote the book, because I realized that my son and I were in this terrible, vicious cycle, and that we had to do something to get out of it. I had to definitely address that situation, a conflict in our home, and find a way out of it.
Talk to Catherine about the dynamic between, you have two sons. You have Buzz and you have Max, and then you have your husband. Max and your husband do not have ADHD and are sort of very, I guess your husband in particular is a very calm person.
Yeah, too calm. But he balances us out, I suppose. No, he's tremendous, and I love him so much. I kind of give it to him a little bit in the book, because for much of our experience with our sons, I felt that he just wasn't worrying enough. Mm-hmm. I had all the worry in the family, which I think is maybe somewhat of a mother's problem in general. But he's been wonderful, and one thing he's definitely offered is a constant sense of humor about things, which I think is just indispensable. But you ask about the relationships in the family, and it's really important, because when you have a diagnosis like this, it's never just limited to the child. There's always an interplay, and in my year of paying attention, I tried to focus in on what was going on with the relationship between Buzz and his brother, and what was going on with the relationship with me and my husband, and how could those things better support all of us so that we'd have more peace in our house.
Mm-hmm. And with the boys, there's such an you describe such an interesting sort of frustration, because you have your son Max sort of easily doing things that most people expect kids to do and excelling at them, and it's not so much effort for him. And you have Buzz trying really hard but messing up on things that require him to focus and be very organized, and so they both sort of feel like the other guy gets all the credit for something.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and there was this dynamic, which I think is pretty common, where the kid who's quote-unquote neurotypical, you know, mm-hmm. the child without the diagnosis, learns to take advantage of the other child's situation because he's wilier and he's savvier about relationships. So he could very quietly tease Buzz, and maybe I wouldn't hear it, but I would see Buzz crash across the room to womp on him. Mm-hmm. And so part of the paying attention was just really paying attention to how Max was gaining from the situation with Buzz and not favoring either one of them.
You have one incident that you describe very early in the book where you're driving down the freeway in a rush to get somewhere, and Buzz has a complete meltdown demanding coffee or a Coke or something. And first of all, tell us a little bit about that day.
Well, at that point in my life, I was ready to write a book about plastic pollution, and I basically had an editor waiting and a contract ready to sign, and I just had to finish the proposal, but I wasn't finishing it for some reason, although I was so excited because this was going to give me a pretext to travel all over the world and do reporting, and I wouldn't have to deal with what was going on at home. And so I was getting all ready to do that, but we had this fight in the freeway, and I realized it was similar to so many other fights we had where we're just in this terrible dynamic as a family, and it was only going to get worse because he was going into his teens. And it was really that day, as I describe in the book, that made me think, I've got to tune in. I have to dedicate my work hours to seeing if there's a way that I can straighten this out, because otherwise it could just ruin our family.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Ellison. Her new book is called Buzz, A Year of Paying Attention. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Ellison. Her new book is called Buzz, A Year of Paying Attention. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Catherine, when Buzz was, you know, demanding coffee at an inappropriate time, did it occur to you for one second maybe he's like self-medicating, like he needs some caffeine to kind of bring him into focus?
It sure did. That's one of the reasons that we eventually did try the stimulants, even though I was initially so opposed and so was my husband, because it was clear that he was looking for something like that, and he'd started drinking energy drinks, you know, which, as most parents know, the things like this are pretty hard to absolutely prevent if your child is determined.
Yeah.
And Buzz has a very strong will. So he would find these drinks, and they're actually very, very bad for you and unregulated. So, you know, for a year we ended up with the stimulants, which at least there's a lot of research on, and you know what you're getting into.
I have to tell you, I almost, you know, started to choke up when I read how willingly he took the first dose of medication.
Yeah. Well, because I think it was very important that my husband and I talked it over and really presented a united front. And we were able to show him that we really thought that this was in his best interest. And he did trust us despite his tremendous bluster and oppositional behavior through most of the time.
Can you describe from your perspective and maybe even from his, how your brain works differently from people that don't have this disorder?
Sure. There's been a lot of recent progress lately. Scientists have really tracked down for most people with serious symptoms of ADHD, there's a problem in processing a neurotransmitter or a kind of a brain chemical called dopamine. And dopamine is very important in motivation and sustained attention and just interest in things. So some scientists have characterized the problem as having like a sleepy brain that needs to be woken up. Many parents are impressed by the way that their children can hang around for hours with video games, but they're very high reward stimulating situations. It's not like your traditional classroom. Whereas if I imagine sitting in the classrooms that my son still has to sit in, I think I go insane. You know, during the time that I'm working during the day, I chew gum, I get up, I walk around. And most children just aren't able to sort of wake up their brain that way. So it's really no wonder that they end up fidgeting or acting out in class.
And if they're not engaged, they can't remember anything.
Well, that's actually, there's a separate problem. Yes, it's really important for them to be engaged, but also, you know, ADHD is really a grab bag of symptoms, and that's one of the things that makes it so difficult. It's just a bunch of different symptoms, and one of the very common ones is a poor short-term memory, poor working memory, and it's thought that that also might have something to do with dopamine. But again, in a classroom situation, if the teacher says, children, take out your books, turn to page 43, and underline the first paragraph, your child is lost at get out your books. I mean, he just can't hold all that in his mind. So they just have a terrible time going through the school system.
The other challenge, and it comes through in the book, for families who are dealing with this condition, whether it's simply a child or a child and a parent or more than one child, is that it seems that everyone else in the world, Catherine, knows exactly what you ought to be doing with your kid and what you're doing wrong.
That's a huge problem. And I really have thought of the blessings that my son has brought to me through this journey that we've taken. And one of them is really to be able to have a thicker skin about what everybody else is telling you. Mm-hmm. Even my father, once we finally tried medication, which was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made in my life, he sent me a little cartoon of a billboard with a child's face that says, Ritalin, so much easier than parenting. You know, I mean, the judgment that people inflict on you, and I'll tell you, it's particularly difficult when a lot of us parents are up late at night trolling the internet looking for miracle cures.
Yeah.
And after almost every article about ADHD, you invariably will find somebody who says, what these kids need is a good kick in the pants, or, you know, my parents just hit me a few times and I shut up.
Like it's a discipline thing.
Yeah, well, there's a big faction out there that think that this problem is made up and or the best way to approach it is corporal punishment. And again, the science shows that this actually would be a very counterproductive approach. One of the hallmarks of this condition is that you don't think about long-range consequences. You don't think that much about getting punished in the moment. So it's not that effective, and it often really hurts the kid's mental health.
And then the tutor that you had been working with that you really liked and Buzz really liked said, I don't work with kids who have been drugged. And that was her words exactly.
Yeah, this was a really painful story that I kind of lay out in the book, because here I'd found this ally who I just adored her, and she was so wonderful with my son. She was helping him. She wasn't helping him enough. He was still getting into so much trouble at school that it was an absolute crisis, you know, at home and at school. So we needed something more. I ended up, what really pushed me over the edge was my uncle, who's a child psychiatrist, after hearing about what was going on in our family, which was pretty serious, said it's imperative that you try medication. So we did for just a year. And I just want to stop here and say that studies have shown that kids really don't stay on the medication on average for longer than a year. So again, medication can be really effective in some situations. It's not a magic bullet. You can't count on it, unfortunately. Even though it's the most common treatment in the United States right now, it's not a guaranteed fix-it. But anyway, this tutor, when I told her, because I was very honest with her about everything, when I told her that we were going to try medication, she said she had a 30-year policy that she didn't work with kids who were drugged, and she promptly started sending me all this stuff, all these website links, primarily from Peter Breggin, who's written a book called Talking Back to Ritalin. And Peter Breggin is a former Scientologist who's one of the leading figures who talks against medication. I mean, it's just the worst thing that's ever happened, you know, to children, and parents should be, you know, definitely castigated for this. And while I do have many reservations about the medications, I think that he plays a big role in, unfortunately, in shaming a lot of parents and probably doing some harm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Hey, I appreciate you talking about the subject. I have a son who's now 15. When he was 4, he was diagnosed as having ADHD. And we went through the same thing about trying to decide whether to give him medicine. But honestly, just initially finding someone who would even help us was the biggest challenge, because he was a little kid. They didn't want to even deal with him. But eventually went to the medicine. And I don't know if he really has ADHD, because it seems like grades were not a problem. He's a straight-A student and has been. But what the Ritalin, or it wasn't really Ritalin, it was some other name drug, I can't remember, something similar. But what it did for him was to help him with his, what I think is, was just impulsivity. And the problems that he was getting into was really hard on his self-esteem. And just being able to overcome those issues long enough to find that he could understand what he was feeling and know how to deal with it was helpful enough for us to get through. Eventually, he stopped taking the medicine, but he's still a kid who taps his foot a lot, or, you know, bounces his legs. But it's not the school thing, not the studying part that's the problem. So I don't really know. Is there some other sort of disorder that really just relates to being impulsive? Do you have any comments?
You know, as I mentioned before, ADHD is really a grab bag of different symptoms, and you can have some and not others. One of the definite hallmarks is this impulsive, you know, lack of self-control. I'm wondering if he ever got into any sports, because there's a lot of really good research that shows that if a child has regular exercise, it's very stimulating and good for the brain, and it might really effectively, it might help with some of that impulsivity.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Yeah, exercise, Catherine, you write that you've always been a nut for it and didn't ever understand why you were so drawn to it, and it might have been your own way of sort of helping yourself.
I'm sure it is, because I know that I'm basically addicted. I don't feel good if I don't get some aerobic exercise during the day. And I know that afterwards, you know, I'm much more able to write well.
Yeah.
I feel more clear-headed. So I've also seen this with my son. We tried a private school for a year, and I was so excited because they had small classes, and, you know, they seemed to understand kids like him. But they didn't have any PE. It was so small that they didn't have any physical education, and they had all sorts of behavior problems. Whereas there's been a lot of reporting on schools that have actually expanded PE, gone against the national trend, and they've cut down their behavior incidences.
Yeah, it's really amazing in schools now, and I understand the academics are important, but it seems like every kid needs time at recess and time in gym to just run around.
Yeah, I think that there's something really wrong with the way that we school all kids now with the huge classes, a teacher going on. And luckily, encouragingly, there's many experiments in having education be more engaging with kids out of their chair more.
Did you feel, Catherine, like Buzz's teachers were with you or against you?
A couple, particularly one who I describe in the book, was just fantastic, and he had his best year ever. It was so clear that he was responding to her. She had a sense of humor. She started the day off with calisthenics. She'd do a spontaneous hokey pokey in the middle of the day. I mean, she was just tremendous. Unfortunately, he had about three teachers that were just really damaging to his self-esteem. I mean, teachers who would just bark at him because he couldn't stop moving. And, there's a lot of ignorance about this condition in schools throughout the United States. I came across one school district in Massachusetts that was actually making hyperactive kids wear lead vests to weigh them down. So that not only gave them backaches, but made them look really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So it was exactly the wrong approach, but, teachers get frustrated. But there needs to be a lot more awareness, a lot more education, because it'd be better for teachers. I understand how having one kid like this can just make your life hell, in a classroom. You have to manage the class. You have to do what's right for everybody in the class, but there are definitely ways to manage kids like this that will make your whole day go more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I think your candor in the book was really impressive, but there's one point, and I'll have to paraphrase here because I can't find the little sticky note that I made, but basically you said, here it is. I adore him, I'd lay my life down for him, but it is just so hard to be with him.
Yeah, that was one of those moments of honesty, but I think a lot of parents feel like that, and it's very tough for parents in this situation because, look, we're in a down economy. A lot of us are having to work pretty hard to make a living. Kids like this, there's no two ways around it. They're extra stressful. They bring you a lot of criticism from other parents and teachers who don't understand. You feel like a failure. It's hard for your self-esteem, even as you're trying to prop up their self-esteem. And they're also very often, kids with this condition can be very they're very high energy and kind of relentless. If they get an idea, they're just lobbing you that night and day. So what I found, and one of the things that I tried to accomplish in my book, was it was really important for me to understand why I was reacting in such a hot-headed way to him and to calm myself down, to do whatever it took to find ways to, relieve my own stress and calm myself down so that we could just have an easier dynamic between the two of us.
Yeah, what is it you say? It's like being on an airplane. You have to put your mask on first before you adjust the child's mask.
It's really true because I had to take a really close look and kind of get out of denial that, I was doing the best I could and I was, I was a sacrificing mom and everything was fine. I had to kind of break through that and really recognize how I was actually contributing to some of our arguments and maybe even in subtle ways egging him on for reasons I'm still not sure of. But it's often quite important as a first step to just sit down with yourself and look at what you might be contributing to the conflict.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Lizzie in Lake Dallas. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you for taking my call, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in this topic because I am a writer also, and I understand, I resonate with a lot of things that you say about, having to follow through and picking the profession, sort of self-medicating. I have a son who is tested in the top 1% of all, seventh graders in his class, but we have tremendous issues. I mean, he's in gifted classes, he's off the charts intelligent, but we just have tremendous issues with following through and organization. And since I have the same issues, we've had so many times when, come to find out there's like 20 assignments he just didn't follow through on in his Excel class and almost flunked the class. And I guess the question I'm wondering is, how do you really know if this is just a personality trait where you're just have trouble focusing and staying interested if something is not just fascinating and engaging, or if you truly have this syndrome?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, gee, I'd say, you can call it a personality trait or a condition or an impairment. Whatever you call it, here's a really smart kid who's having a really tough time with the school system. I guess the bottom line is, you know, get the help you need and know where your limits are. I've talked to so many moms, and I used to be one of them, who waste endless hours yelling at their sons about or daughters about homework. And if you can outsource that, if you can get some help from school, if you can get a tutor to just make that not be part of your relationship, that can help tremendously. You know, look for help where it's available. A lot of schools have after-school programs. Organizational problems are not to be, you know, they're not minor problems, because here you have somebody who's so bright and with so much potential, but he's getting thwarted in the school system. Some schools are being very innovative in providing support, good effective support, but sometimes you really have to look for it. And I describe in the book just how I got educated about what my rights were within the school system and what I could ask for.
One of the things you talk about here that has come up on this program before in different situations is that sometimes programs that are put in place to help kids with ADD and ADHD actually turn out to be good for everybody.
I think that's really true, because as I mentioned before, if there's a teacher who's trying to manage 30 kids in a class and one or two of them are talking out, acting up, and it's just really impossible, you can't just ignore those kids and just hope that they'll go away or send them to the principal's office and, you know, eventually ruin their lives with all this discipline that doesn't work. The really creative, smart teachers find ways to cope with them, like something as simple as letting them sit on a football, letting them chew gum. My son used to get detentions for chewing gum. I chew gum all the time when I'm working. It helps. It's just a way of fidgeting, you know, that as long as you don't stick it on your desk, I don't see what's wrong with it. But other teachers will have the kids, the more hyperactive kids, those will be the ones that they're allowed to pass out papers or go do the errand at at somebody else's office. You just have to take a little bit of extra time to kind of understand and maybe not judge them as evil or naughty. They're just trying to survive like you are.
Catherine Ellison is my guest. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new memoir, Buzz, A Year of Paying Attention. We'll get to more of your calls after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Catherine Ellison is my guest. Her new memoir is called Buzz, A Year of Paying Attention. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Jason in Dallas. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I was actually wanting to both make a comment and kind of get some input from your guest. I myself actually have ADD, which I was diagnosed with as a child, but never did any sort of medication until I entered the professional world. And I'm just wanting to find out what your guest's thoughts and observations are on how ADD and ADHD affect those children that have problems, and how it carries over into their personal and professional adult lives.
Yeah, it doesn't often simply go away. Is that right, Catherine?
Yeah, that's right. I think the great majority of people who have it as children end up having it as adults, but you learn ways throughout your life, as I'm sure you have, to cope with it. Some might be good, some might not be so good. A lot of people end up medicating with drugs, you know, recreational drugs or alcohol, because it can be a really difficult thing, obviously, to deal with. It impairs your personal relationships and your work, and you often have trouble finishing projects. So it's something that you really, really have to engage with.
One of the non-drug interventions that was good for both you and for Buzz was neurofeedback. Can you talk about how that works?
Sure, I'd be glad to. And I want to say that I've continued to write about this. I've written stories on neurofeedback in particular for both the Washington Post and the New York Times. And they're available on my website at www.katherineellison.com. Because it would take way too long to talk about all the interesting evidence that's come up that neurofeedback actually can cope with at least some of the symptoms of this condition. But basically, it's biofeedback for the brain. Mm-hmm. You're working with a computer where you're watching images, and to the degree that you succeed in getting your brain to a more calm and focused state, you get rewarded, and it encourages you and trains you to do it more. So with enough sessions, you theoretically at least end up doing this outside the neurofeedback practitioner's office. Both my son and I did about 40, 50 sessions of neurofeedback, and we were very lucky and privileged because we had the book Advance to help us. One of the unfortunate realities about neurofeedback, though, is that it's highly expensive and it's time-consuming. So it's the rare family, unfortunately, since so many insurance companies don't cover it, it's the rare family that can really try this out. But I think that as more evidence accumulates, as it is, that neurofeedback can help a variety of mental health conditions, we might be seeing more insurance companies pay for it.
So another concern that you had was food additives and the effect that they can have on people with ADHD. And, of course, the FDA came down just last week and said food coloring does not appear to be directly linked. Were you disappointed by that ruling?
Well, I have to say that I wonder why they had such a quick and adamant response when studies in The Lancet, which is a very prestigious British medical journal, have summed a lot of evidence that at least the symptoms can be aggravated by artificial food colorings and preservatives. And there was a more recent Lancet study that generated a lot of reporting that suggested that if you try your child on an elimination diet, start them out with very simple foods to test for food sensitivities, you can cut down a lot of the symptoms. And there's enough smoke there that I think it really should be investigated more.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Barbara in Dallas. Hello, Barbara.
Hi. I'd be interested in what insight you have about helicopter parents. Our son was diagnosed in the second grade with ADD. He's 25 now. But I have tried to stay involved in his life and sort of looking over important things to make sure they get done. And I know the philosophy about helicopter parents is that we should let our children fail. They learn from failing. But in some of these ADD kids, when they fail, they go out flaming. And I can't believe that that's a good thing. But I've not been able to find any guidance about where you draw the line.
That's such a good question because so many of these, I think parents are all struggling to walk that line between you don't want to spoil your kids, you don't want to protect them from all failure because failure is one of the greatest learning experiences around, but you clearly see just the risks are greater. The studies do show that the outcomes, long-term outcomes are not that encouraging. And so kids like this need extra support. I think that's just for sure. But then the degree to which you give it, you just have to look at your individual case and I think really trust your instincts and talk to other mothers who are in the same position. I think that's incredibly helpful. And get all the help that you can to walk that line because nobody, although there's so many books that promise you some kind of authoritative treatment and, a 3-day cure, nobody knows your child better than you, and nobody's going to give you that magic bullet.
What did it take for you to help Buzz manage his social life, which at least initially the ADHD ended up being a real hindrance to him keeping friends?
Yeah, and actually I think that was probably more important than any trouble that he got into at school because obviously kids at this age, it's friends mean everything to them. And if you're not a good listener or sharer or, you haven't mastered those social skills that always involve a lot of self-control, you're just going to have a terrible time. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to him. So the best I could do there, I couldn't force him into social situations, but the best I could do was just give him a lot of love, try to model self-control, talk to him constantly about the value of self-control. And I think in that way, we got to a better place in our relationship, and that was a better model for him for other relationships.
You have such a good sense of humor about having dealt with this. Does Buzz have a sense of humor about his condition?
Oh, he's hilarious. He provides some of the best lines in the book. I mean, my two kids and my husband were just gifts. You know, and I want to say that we have a great sage out here in the San Francisco Bay Area. His name is Wavy Gravy, and I love to quote him because he says, if you can't laugh, you've got to laugh, because otherwise it's just not funny. And I found humor to be the absolute best coping strategy to deal with this, because bad things are going to happen, and it's how you react to them, and you can't take everything quite so seriously.
Let's go on the phones next to Wesley in Fort Worth. Hi, Wesley.
Hi, I'm a third-year medical student here in Fort Worth, and I was just got into the conversation, so I hope I haven't bringing up a topic that's already been discussed, but I was wondering, actually, if you could discuss how your interactions were with a lot of your physicians that you had gone to see, and what their opinions were of your son's condition, and how they thought your condition was different than, say, other conditions where parents are just looking for a quick fix or, you know, a drug regimen that would potentially help a child that may not have ADHD.
Well, you know, I described the initial interview with the one doctor who was covered by our insurance, who was a pediatric psychiatrist, and I wasn't very impressed because, as we mentioned earlier, he diagnosed my son after like less than, I think it was 15 minutes, and prescribed medication. So a lot of pediatricians are very quick to offer medication because they just have limited time, and they know that, you know, chances are it'll help, at least in the short term, and they might not be able to explain all the incredibly fraught, you know, risks and benefits. And so that's a real problem. I think the medical system in our country is not equipped to handle this in a constructive way. I'm going to be talking to a group of Kaiser specialists, mental health specialists, next month, and that's a place that actually is really looking at more helpful treatments, one of which is having a nurse actually follow up with families. I mean, what a concept to actually follow up after a prescription and see how things are going, because so many families are just overwhelmed. They can barely get to the pediatrician, and they're grasping at straws, and they're not getting a lot of formal support. So anything that society can do to give them some more support, I think, is great.
And if properly prescribed, I know the medications can have a beneficial impact, but they carry with them some serious side effects for growing kids, including insomnia and loss of appetite and sometimes weight loss.
Yeah, that's right. And what's been documented is that they definitely do have an effect on height. My son was already vertically challenged, so that was a big consideration for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that truly has been documented. But I want to say that there's a lot of scare stories on the web that you'll run into. There's headlines, some of which were sent to us by, you know, purported friends. There's headlines about the meds will cause depression, they'll cause cancer, they'll, you know, cause heart attacks. And one thing I did scrupulously in the book is I put on my journalist hat, I went back to these studies, I talked to the people who did them, and I found out that a lot of that is not at all what it seems.
Why do you think we are so much more uncomfortable and judgmental about prescribing medication for a mental illness or condition than we are for anything physiological?
You know, that's a great question. There's something that has been described as psychopharmacological Calvinism, you know, which is this expectation that you're going to, you know, it's a character flaw, and you deal with it because I dealt with it, and nobody can be inside somebody else's skull, unfortunately. So people that are having a pretty easy time managing do get very judgmental, and because it's invisible, and especially a condition like ADHD where, you know, one of the great attributes of it is that you're misbehaving and you're, you know, less than trustworthy in some situations, and you're just causing problems for people, that it's one of the situations where parents and the kids get judged so much, because there just isn't enough, unfortunately, understanding of it.
Buzz also was diagnosed with something called oppositional defiant disorder, which even before you know anything about it, sounds like a terrible thing to have to deal with as a mother. How do you decide, you know, when you need to sort of cut him some slack and understand that his brain works differently, and when you need to sort of, you know, set your foot down?
That was an absolute fundamental question that I tried to address all the way through the book, because it's not easy, because sometimes you just think, you know, I shortened oppositional defiant disorder to just being a pain in the neck, you know, because that's basically, it's a more controversial diagnosis even than ADHD because it's very vague, you know, and it's just mental health specialists putting a name on something that, on the other hand, what researchers have actually found that it occurs in up to like 60% of kids with ADHD, really high, that these kids are truly arguing with you all the time, they're unhappy, they're frustrated, and they're taking it out on you. So I think it does involve trying to be more compassionate, look at what's really happening. Why are they... What's going on in their mind that they're responding to like this, and what's a good way of getting out of that conflict situation?
So throughout the course of the book, we follow Buzz sort of preparing for his bar mitzvah, and you close the book with the scene of him finally achieving this, which is a big deal, and certainly that preparation takes a lot of concentration. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was so happy that went well. I kind of took a chance when I first described the book. Oh, this is going to lead up to my son's bar mitzvah, and I had no idea whether it was going to be the most embarrassing day of my life or not, and his, and like, you know, this would be the history that would, you know, confirm us as total failures. But, it, you know, to give away the book's ending, it turned out pretty well. I mean, he did a beautiful job, and part of this whole journey for me was learning, and I learned with my son and with other people, how to really focus my attention on the best in them and help put them in situations where they can shine. And of all the interventions, I think that's one of the absolute best ones. Help your child find his bliss. Find something where, you know, where he can be on a stage and get actually positive feedback after getting so much negative feedback, because that is the best therapy in the world.
Have you learned to give yourself a break more often than you used to?
Definitely. I'm pretty hard charging. I'm pretty hardworking. Everybody in my family is. I'm the only one. There are four of us. Three are doctors, and then there's me. We just grew up in a culture where we work really hard and drive ourselves. So it took a lot for me to start slowing down and realizing when I needed to just tune in or do things that would relieve stress, or just facing how much stress we were coping with, and as you say, giving myself a break. And I just really advocate that parents in this situation try to be aware of that, because then you're doing the best thing in the world for your children.
Mm-hmm. And Buzz is in high school now. Things are going okay?
You know, knock wood. He just got on the tennis team. He's got a much better social situation, and he's doing really well.
I'm really glad to hear that.
Thank you.
The new memoir by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Ellison is called Buzz, A Year of Paying Attention. Catherine, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. It was great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.